If you ask a personal finance expert what to do when financial markets appear to be freaking out, they generally say nothing, which is good advice, especially if you're talking about the long haul. Just sit tight and breathe. But human psychology can push us to spend these moments assessing our own security, economic and otherwise. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. We're not going to go too heavy on the markets this week, but we are going to do a gut check of sorts about how we feel about the economy. It's a way of putting things in perspective and also finally kicking off an election year and where you fit into it. Come talk to us about what matters to you at MarketplaceWeekend.org, on Marketplace's Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. I mentioned assessing where we are economically. It was the first question we ever asked you. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And to be fair, we stole the line from Ronald Reagan. But it's a good framework for thinking about your economic life, especially as we enter the election year in earnest. Plus, how we feel about our personal economies can have a big impact on how we vote. We were inundated with responses. There were people like Hans Mulders in Washington who gave us an unequivocal yes, because before was rough.
So in January or February 2010, right at the height of the downturn, I was a general manager of a large hotel on the shore of New Jersey, and business went completely downhill. I mean, we were down at one point in time 50% of previous year revenue, so really catastrophic. We had to do some horrible things, and the way that I was asked to do them was very unpalatable to me.
Like letting people go?
Yeah. And listen, a business has to survive, so I get that. But it's only the lowest paid employees that pay the price for these downturns. It's never anything is asked of managers. It just is against everything that I believe in. And I went home, said to my wife, look, I'm done. I can't be an employee anymore. I just can't do it. And we took every nickel that we ever saved in our lives, which was a pretty substantial sum, and plunked it into buying a hotel in Leavenworth, Washington. By total happenstance, by the way, we ended up here. And have never looked back. I mean, it's been unbelievable. I'm like, and why didn't I do this 20 years ago?
You took a huge risk doing this.
Yes.
What did it take to do that?
You know, I mean, I walked away from a $175,000 a year job. I just couldn't stomach it anymore. You know, there comes a point in your life where you say, ultimately, what am I willing to give up if this doesn't go the way I hope it goes? And I was willing to give up a lot. I was willing to lose it all. Like, really, that's how fed up I was with the way that we were asked to do things. You know, to me, my employees are what drives my business. And I'm an independent hotel, you know, no name, no brand, no nothing, and we're running more than 70% occupancy every year. It is about the people, and big companies, they're completely obtuse to it, especially corporate office folks, sadly to say.
Hans Mulders, thank you so much for talking with us.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Lizzie.
Then people like Ellen Johnson. She owns a women's clothing store in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and online shopping and cheap imported items have really hurt her business.
The bottom line is people shop price point. That's been my experience. And, you know, when you have an item that's been imported that they can buy for, you know, $24.99, and then you show them another item that's made in America at $59.99, 9 times out of 10, they go for the less expensive item.
When you think about maybe the next 4 years coming up, do you feel optimistic?
Well, I think that depends how the election goes, to tell you the truth. You know, the middle class is what moves my business. They're the people who shop in my store. And they're the people who are really in my community who support my business. And if they're strong, then I'll be strong. If they're not strong, then I'm not going to be strong. So I'm relying on that.
You know, the internet and overseas manufacturing aren't going away. So what do you think about your business in the next few years?
Quite honestly, I don't think I will be in business in the next 5 years.
Wow. How do you feel about that?
Well, it's just such a struggle, you know. I employ people and, you know, I feel responsible to them, and that's why I keep trying to go and go and go, but I think it's going to come to a point where I won't be able to do it anymore. Don't get me wrong. I'm doing everything I can to hopefully turn it around so that doesn't come true. But, you know, I also want to be realistic, big picture, about what I see happening to the small retailers.
Yeah, yeah. Ellen Johnson, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks, Lizzie. Take care.
And last, Renee Anise in Florida. She's uncertain, better, but not great. The future is scary. So that whole better off thing?
I'm on the fence, Lizzie. I'm really on the fence. I went back to school. I finished up my master's degree in business. And because I was just anticipating, you know, all of these blessings from heaven to drop from the sky. And they haven't dropped from the sky yet for me. So I'm kind of getting leery. I'm getting nervous about what's going to happen. You know, who's going to be the president? You know, what's going to happen with jobs and all of that.
When you take stock of your life, what are the things that you think about the most when you're trying to figure out if you're doing better or worse?
Well, I'm looking at my bank account and I'm looking at my car that I'm driving. I'm looking at if I'm able to take my family out to dinner. So right now, I'm driving a 2005 Dodge Durango, and it just hit 250,000 miles. So that's how I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I'm not able to go out and get that new BMW that I wanted to get or Mercedes that I wanted to get that I thought that I would have at this time in my life. And I'm honestly a little disappointed. Here I am. I'm a black female, and I was taught that if you work hard and you really study in school and you live a decent life and you do right by people, that it's all going to pay off. And I just expected a little bit different payoff. I'll just put it that way.
Do you feel like someone or something didn't hold up its end of the bargain?
Well, yes. I feel like our society is failing a lot of people.
Is there anything that does keep you hopeful about the next, I don't know, year, 5 years?
Well, I'm just going to try to keep it as positive as I can. I continue to be a role model for kids at my church, my own family, and try to give back. That's the thing. Just try to give back.
Renee, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We got so many incredible responses that we made a special digital collection of your answers. You can hear them at marketplaceweekend.org and add your experience, because next week we're sticking with this question. So are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? Come tell us why or why not. Talk about your personal economy in this election year at marketplaceweekend.org, on Marketplace's Facebook page, or you can call us 1-800-648-5114. It's been kind of a stressful week in the markets. We have a particularly cool marketplace quiz for you. That is when we ask well-known people to talk about their experiences with money and what it's taught them in their lives. So relax and listen to this one.
What's up? My name is Pusha T, and I'm a rap artist from Virginia Beach, Virginia. When I started my career, I wish someone would have told me to keep it all business. At all times. You know, I came in the game so lackadaisical. You know, I came in the game with my friends, my best friend, and my brother. And it was such a family-oriented thing. And I carried some of that family love and trust. I put that on, like, record labels and things like that. And it didn't always work out in my favor. Thinking, you know, this is a team effort, but this is really, really, really a business. Shrewd business. I realized music could be a career early, maybe the 90s when Teddy Riley moved to my area, super producer Teddy Riley moved to my area, and he had a yellow Ferrari driving down Virginia Beach Boulevard. And I was like, wait a minute, that's a real Ferrari that I see on TV. and it's all, you know, for music. And this is a real thing. Then he went and shot a video called Rump Shaker, which was probably the hottest record for about 2 to 3 years. And he shot it in Virginia Beach. And I was like, ah, this is an even realer thing. You know, all of the women within that video that I thought were like out of reach were actually, you know, close in the area. And I was, you know, as a youngster, I was like, wow, this is an amazing thing. The hardest part about my job that no one knows is dealing with interviews that aren't really when the person isn't really well versed with your career. My most prized possession. I love my car so much. I have a 911 Turbo S. It's like everything. It's black with ox blood red interior. I love it, and I don't get to drive it that much. My first job was, I probably was like 13 years old, and I worked at this restaurant, this seasonal, super fancy restaurant, Blue Pete Seafood. And it was like, I was a busboy, and I probably shouldn't have been working at that time, but I was. It was like something you just did for the summer, and it was great. Something that I bought that I completely regret buying, I'd have to say a plethora of clothes, man. Like I have so many clothes, and I'm like really over it. I'm realizing that I really just want to wear one uniform every day, or something close, like something super, super, super similar. And I feel like that's even a better thing for me to do. If I can find this perfect uniform, then I wouldn't buy clothes ever again.
Pusha T's latest album, King Push, Darkest Before Dawn, The Prelude, is out now. Our stories are often dominated by numbers because that's kind of the nature of money. And here at Marketplace, our By the Numbers blog tracks them and posts them every day on marketplace.org. Here are producers Tony Wagner and Raghu Manavalan with some of this week's news by the numbers. Tony?
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
10,000.
It's how many dollars in engineering fees it takes to replace a home retaining wall in Los Angeles, according to one local construction consultant.
With El Nino drenching Southern California this week, flooding and mudslides are a very real risk.
Construction businesses are seeing full schedules and a lot of money.
14.6.
That's the percentage Chipotle sales fell during the fourth quarter of last year.
The chain's earnings have taken a hit due to several health-related incidents at locations nationwide.
A norovirus outbreak in Southern California affected 100 customers back in August, while an E. coli outbreak last fall affected 53 people in 9 different states.
12.
That's the percentage Lego sets have increased in value annually on average since 2000.
British paper The Telegraph analyzed resale prices and found out-of-production sets can appreciate in value up to 2,200%.
The upside, those little plastic bricks might be a better investment than stocks or gold.
Raghu, this is great news.
Okay, why?
Well, you see, all my retirement savings are tied up in a $400 Death Star set.
Dude, you have to diversify.
And here's another big number, 99 million. That's the number of investors in China's stock market. Big losses there started a week of ups and downs, and mostly downs, around the world. Here's another number, 25, because the market in Shanghai only started up again in 1990, and it didn't really assume the form we know it in now until 2006. So in the global history of money, these are short periods of time, new experiments, really, worth keeping in perspective right now. Business news sometimes sounds like its own language. You definitely heard a lot of that this week with markets going nuts. And sometimes that language includes the terms long and short. Long, betting on something, short, betting against it. And we do that here too, but with the news. This week, to tell us what they are long and short, we have Danielle Belton, an associate editor for The Root, and Marketplace's own Washington Bureau chief, Dave Shaw. Welcome to you both.
Thanks.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right, Danielle, you are the guest, so I am going to let you take a swing at your first long. What are you long?
I am going to go long on sci-fi, science fiction, fantasy, television, and film. Right now, it's just really dominating television, scripted television, and the box office, with Marvel and Disney kind of leading the pack with the, you know, their with Star Wars, you know, it's cracking $1 billion domestically, on pace to like beat Avatar internationally. And then you just have so many films coming out this year. IO9, a science fiction fantasy website, chronicled over 75 genre films coming out in 2016, which includes Deadpool, which comes out next month, Captain America Civil War, X-Men Apocalypse, Independence Day 2, the next Star Trek film, Batman versus Superman. I mean, there's just so many of these films coming out. And you got, like, the Daredevils coming out on Netflix soon in March.
Right. Jessica Jones. I was kind of into that one. Yeah.
Yeah, Jessica Jones was awesome.
I need to make a confession. I have not seen the new Star Wars.
Dude.
Oh.
I know.
Dude.
I know.
It's amazing.
It's getting to the point where it's almost inexcusable. Well, all right. So between us, we've each seen it twice.
Yeah, that's actually not how
not
that
how
works.
It works.
No. But all right, you can go long now. What are you long?
All right, so I am going long on symbolism in politics. So there were two big things that happened in politics this week. You had the ACA repeal, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare repealed the vote in the House. It's now before the president, who will certainly veto it. This is very symbolic. And as were, in many ways, the president's recommendations on new gun control measures, which also came this week. Many of them sounded familiar because many of them he first proposed after the Sandy Hook massacre more than 2 years ago. So the symbolic nature of our politics is about to take over, and there will be a lot of symbolism.
Right. I mean, we're in an election year. Symbolism is important. But, like, does any of this stuff take effect?
Yeah, you have to think, like, when people talked about the president's gun control measures, there was sweeping language about it. And it was cast in these very stark terms. But you have to have the reality check to say, you know, actually, we're not talking about that much change from what we have right now.
Danielle, what are you short?
You know, I am short with Twitter right now. Like, you know, they're
because they're about to be long.
Oh. Exactly.
I'm sorry, this is not a segment for dad jokes, but go ahead, Danielle.
So, you know, Twitter announced this week that they're considering making it so you could make a 10,000-word tweet, which to me sounds like a horrible, horrible, horrible idea. Like, I don't really understand it. Like, I get where they're going with this, because people are taking screenshots of text, of blocks of text, and tweeting that, which I also find
guilty
kind
as charged.
Mildly annoying. But I would rather have that than someone, like, basically write the War and Peace of tweets and then throw that up on the internet.
Yeah, I like the punchiness. I like 140 characters.
Yeah, the brevity really causes lots of creativity. There's been some amazing, like, you know, six-word stories, you know, memes, just really funny tweets that are inspired out of the fact that Twitter is short. Sometimes I feel like Twitter is run by people who don't actually use Twitter and don't understand why people like the medium. I mean, if they were going to do anything, why didn't they create an edit button?
I was thinking about this. It would need to make it really clear that the edit had happened, because people respond to and interact with what was originally there. You could really sandbag somebody.
Yeah, Facebook does it. It'll say edited if you edit your posts. So it's a totally doable. And imagine, like, how many, you know, people's careers could be saved if there was an edit button.
Be like, no, I didn't quite mean it that way.
Right. Instead of the deleted tweets being the problem, it would be the edited tweets.
Yes.
All right, Dave Shaw, what are you short?
I am going short on daily fantasy sports. FanDuel, DraftKings, as you know, we've got playoff football. I think this season, this past football season, was the one where it went nuts. And, you know, in addition to the Attorney General in New York and a reported investigation by the Justice Department and the FBI, all of these different states, as they get back to work in the new year, are looking at ways of regulating this. Mm. Many of them call it gambling, you know, not a game of skill. And so I think that this was the big season for it. And I don't know that it'll be able to recapture that magic.
Fair enough. Danielle Belton from The Root, Dave Shaw, our Washington Bureau Chief, thank you both very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
What? you don't recognize the 1986 mega hit Ram It? Yeah, by the 1986 Los Angeles Rams. The Rams, of course, moved to St. Louis, but they are now looking to come back to L.A. So are two other football teams, the Oakland Raiders and the San Diego Chargers. And the NFL is sorting out which team, if any, will make the expensive trip. Our sports guy, Lee Eagle, is the co-chair of NYU's Sports and Society Department, and he came back here to talk about this. Hi, Lee.
Hi. How you doing?
So we have heard rumors many, many, many times that an NFL team is going to go to L.A. I mean, I feel like this has happened ad nauseum for the past two decades. What is different now?
What's different now about NFL teams looking to relocate to Los Angeles is that, like so many things, you have sort of a perfect mix of time and place. And that really means that what's changed is, one, some parts of lease agreements have come due, and the landscape, the entire business landscape, has changed.
We've seen teams threaten to do this in the past as kind of a game of chicken with wherever they are now. You know, they want more money for a new stadium or something like that. Does this cause a domino effect among other teams in the league, or is this really about actually getting to LA?
There are a few things going on here. One is you have the NFL, which is the number one league in terms of revenue in the United States, without a franchise in one of the largest television markets in the country, even in the world. So we've got that part of it. We've also got a bit of business going on just in and around the city. So you look at Los Angeles, where when the Rams and the Raiders moved away, L.A. wasn't the city that it is today. Certainly it was a major American city, but you can actually look and see where sports has been the centerpiece to growth and development of the cities. There are areas where around the Staples Center, for example, that have been revitalized. And that's really a big part of the play here. There has been traditionally some cat and mouse between cities and owners and leagues and that sort of interplay. But now it's a little bit different in that we've got three franchises that have, at least according to their own people, legitimate reasons to move. And it's actually less of a cat and mouse game here than it is a chess match between these three franchises.
So what's standing in the way of this happening?
There are a few different things going on. One is we've got to look at what's going on in the lease agreements, and they tend to be, from in the public, one of the most overlooked things, because how many people really want to read through lease agreements or start talking about debt markets or any of the things that are involved?
Yeah, wow, that's sort of an eyeball glazing.
Except for the people who are doing the business on it. One of the other interesting plays here about that's a potential roadblock is three teams trying to move to one city that could accommodate at least, arguably, at least one franchise, maybe two, and who's going to win out. And the real dynamic there is that you've got the San Diego Chargers and the Oakland Raiders looking to move together into a facility. You got the St. Louis Rams looking to move to L.A. into a different facility. And I think that's where a lot of the action really is.
And the owners have to agree on this too, right?
It's got to go through ownership. It also, interestingly enough, in a way has to go through the cities. So that's why you're seeing each of the cities has something to the effect of a town hall meeting, and you can see a real buildup. There is an agreement between the NFL and mayors of major American cities, at least the ones that have the NFL franchises in them. There's an actual process here. It's not like in 1984, the Baltimore Colts left in the dead of night, packed up the Mayflower moving trucks, and moved from Baltimore to Indianapolis. People literally woke up the next morning, the team was gone. And so there are agreements in place that prevent that from happening. And should a relocation process be initiated, there is a pathway. There is some sort of process.
Lee Eagle from NYU Sports and Society Program, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Always a pleasure to be with you.
on the show, we take a suggestion from you and highlight a big money story where you live. This week, we got a note from Louise Height, who wanted us to cover the Alaska LNG project. That stands for liquefied natural gas. And the price tag for the state could be up to $65 billion. But it's almost impossible to know if the project is worth it because no one knows what natural gas will sell for in the future. We called up Rachel Waldholtz, the energy reporter for Alaska Public Media. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Can you kind of set the scene for us a little bit? What is the Alaska LNG project anyway?
Well, the Alaska LNG project is the most recent iteration of Alaska's sort of longtime dream to build a natural gas pipeline from the North Slope. Alaska obviously has a ton of oil reserves up there. We also have a ton of natural gas, and the state has been hoping since the 70s to build a pipeline to bring that gas to market. And so this project, sort of the most recent version of it, is an estimated $45 to $65 billion project to build an 800-mile pipeline from the North Slope down to Nikiski, which is in sort of south-central Alaska, and export the gas to Asia.
The big question here, of course, is it worth it? And that, I guess, depends what? On the market and on the price, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so this project has been a dream of Alaska's, you know, literally for going on 40 years now. And the reason it hasn't ever happened is because the economics have never quite made sense, that it's very expensive to get the gas from the North Slope to market. There's been attempts to bring it down to the lower 48. Now the goal is to take it to market in Asia. And it's never made sense before. And one of the reasons it's never made sense also is that the natural gas is being used up there. It's re-injected into the ground to help oil production. So it's actually been more valuable to increase oil production than to ship it as natural gas. And so the question is whether that balance has tipped, whether it's actually worth it to ship it now, and then whether we can do it and actually ship it at a price that would be competitive on the global market.
Can you put this into a little bit of perspective for me in terms of how the state is doing financially now? A while back on the show, we talked about kind of the effects that falling oil prices had had on Alaska's budget. And I wonder, you know, does it make sense to the state's coffers to try to sell natural gas?
Well, I think that for a lot of Alaskans, they're seeing this natural gas pipeline as a lifeline because our finances right now are a bit of a disaster. Alaska right now has a $3.5 billion budget deficit. That's out of a total $5 billion state operating budget. So it's two-thirds of our budget this year is a deficit. And that's because we have historically gotten most of our revenue from oil and gas taxes. So it's pretty nuts, the impact of falling oil prices. And then we have a longer term problem, which is falling oil production. Sort of production on the North Slope peaked in the late 80s, and it's been on a long term decline. And so a lot of state lawmakers in Alaska and a lot of Alaskans see natural gas as the thing that will save us, the thing that will make it possible for Alaska to continue funding state government in the way it has in the past, which is pretty much all sort of through resource extraction.
This pipeline would be a consortium, really sort of a public-private one. I'm curious how residents in the state have reacted to this. You know, our question came from someone who says they were buying up land and homes to make room. But then I would imagine other people think, hey, yay, money.
Yeah, you know, there isn't a lot of opposition to this idea. I think plenty of Alaskans view any talk of a natural gas pipeline with skepticism because they've been hearing about it for, you know, literally decades at this point. So there's certainly skepticism, but you would be hard pressed to find someone who's opposed to the idea of a pipeline in general. I think, you know, Alaskans, we live off the Trans-Alaska pipeline. So I think that people really see a new pipeline as a plus. There's plenty of debate over where the pipeline should go, you know, how big it should be. You know, the state is in a partnership with the three big oil companies in Alaska. It's ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips. And, you know, there's a fair amount of skepticism in the state about the big oil companies. But the project overall, I'd say, has a tremendous amount of support, you know, with a fair amount of skepticism.
Maybe this is asking you to you know, predict something you can't. But the state spent more money moving forward. So, you know, is this happening?
Well, that is the huge, that's the $45 to $65 billion question on this pipeline is whether this can actually happen. And nobody knows right now. I mean, the thing that I try to remind our listeners is right now this is an imaginary pipeline. It only exists on paper. There won't even be a decision on whether to break ground until 2019. At the very earliest, it would ship natural gas in 2024 or 2025. And it's not going to get built unless there's a market for it. And so right now, obviously, natural gas prices, like oil prices, are in the tank. But the question for this pipeline is, what will the natural gas market look like in 10 years? And as anyone in Alaska knows, predicting oil and gas prices 10 years out is, sort of a fool's errand.
Rachel Waldholtz is the energy reporter for Alaska Public Media. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Come tell us what's the most important money story where you live. Go to marketplaceweekend.org and click on Local Money. Since it's January, that might mean you are spending money on a new high-tech workout, which we're exploring as one of the ways you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie. Are you ready?
I am ready. We are going to explore fitness and data.
Yeah, we're standing in Chelsea and we're about to go into this place that we're standing right next to. It's called Orange Theory, and it is a place where they monitor pretty closely your data while you do kind of circuit training, fast training. Should we go in?
Great. So we're walking through
Orange hallway.
Yeah.
This is very orange. It's the Orange Theory hallway. We're getting into the orange zone.
Please enter the orange domain.
The orange domain.
Okay.
Wow.
Do you want to
enter the halls of orangeness? I'm Coach Benjamin Horan. I've been working with Orange Theory for a short while here, about February. So I'm excited to show you what we got.
What are you going to do to us?
Yeah. I'm going to torture you and make you sweat. No.
Okay.
I like that.
Cool.
But
okay.
Also you're going to
we're going to get you working. We're going to get you up on that treadmill. We're going to work on a little bit of interval work.
But you're also going to monitor our data, and that includes heart rate. What else?
It includes heart rate, calories that you've burned. It'll monitor which cardiovascular zone you're in.
Okay.
Here at Orange Theory, we've split things out into an array of five different colored zones based on where your heart rate is. So as your heart rate goes up, the color of your block will start to change based on what your heart rate is. So we're going to closely be monitoring that. We're also going to take you into a few different speeds as well. We have what we call base, push, and all out. Base pace being a manageable pace that usually I liken to somewhat of an aerobics class or a nice jog outside, something that's manageable and doable for upwards of 20 or 30 minutes.
As in your usual.
Well, we're basically going to try and treat that as basically your warm-up pace for a short bit. And
Perfect.
Then we're going to go ahead and we're going to increase your speed and a little bit of incline as well while we're at it. So today is a strength workout, so we're going to be working on a little bit of incline on that treadmill today.
Okay.
So as you go there, the color of your block and the percentage of your max heart rate is going to change as your heart rate starts to increase. You're going to go through the gray to the blue to the green, which is our base pace zone. And then you got your orange zone, which is going to be push / all-out zone. And then red, you could even reach up into that red zone as well as you get into that all-out sprint at the very end.
And I understand that this is not about competition.
Correct.
However, let's say that I just happen to be kind of a competitive freak show.
People in New York aren't like that, though.
Do better than he does.
Yeah.
How do I do that?
Lizzie. How do I beat Lizzie?
How do you beat Lizzie?
Here.
You simply try to burn more calories, okay. I suppose, is really. So
if you're trying to trip me, I jump over it.
The thing is like what we really emphasize is that you're trying to better yourself, right? So it really is a competition with yourself, which is why we always keep a really concise log in terms of what we have in the computer systems of the workouts that you've been through. So you have an idea and you can go back and you can look through your emails. Okay, today on this very day, I started out at this level. I burned this many calories. I spent this much time in the orange zone. And then 2 months down the road, those statistics are going to start to change. You're going to start to realize that your cardiovascular ability has started to improve. So it really is a race against yourself. That doesn't go to say that you can't try and beat Joe Schmo over here on the end treadmill who likes to go at a full-out sprint at an incline of 15. By all means, you know, go for it. We just make sure to encourage people that they're doing so in a safe and manageable way that they're not falling over dead afterward.
Yeah. We have to be real, though. You're projecting everybody's stats onto a publicly viewable space.
Sure.
So, like, I know it's not about competition.
It's soft corporal punishment. How's that? It's soft.
Perfect.
Let's go ahead and get to it.
Okay.
So decide what kind of a jogger, runner, power walker you are. Let's go ahead and get you into a base pace. Let's put those inclines up at 1%. Hit the green start button for me, and let's go ahead and get you to what you've decided to be your base pace.
Just for the record, I'm at 5 and she's at 4.7, so I'm just...
So maybe, Liz, you should kick it up a notch, huh? Put it at a 5, get yourself moving. There we go.
There you go. Which one of us ran track in college, Ben?
Oh, not me.
Oh, calling it out. You're almost there. Come on, come on, come on. And you're there in 3. 2. Whew. That's it. How y'all feel?
I feel great.
I feel tired.
Little sparkling.
Little glistening. I'm glistening. A little there glistening.
Just tell us who won.
I will not do that. Absolutely not. You're both winners. Right? You're both winners.
Okay, so we are done.
That was beat me handily.
I did.
I would say.
Yep.
Yeah.
Totally.
It was really interesting to see a space where a bunch of people are all like looking at their own data while they're actually working out.
We've talked about fitness apps before.
Uh-huh.
What makes this different? And is this approach something that you see becoming more popular?
So I think we've seen a lot of things happen in the past couple of years when it comes to wearables and when it comes to data tracking, the quantified self. You could almost call this in some ways the quantified group, right?
Yeah.
Because you have a group of people who are
multiple
all working out.
Multiple names are up there.
Multiple names are up there. We're monitoring their data all at the same time in the studio we were just in. But they don't hold on to the data, which is kind of interesting. You basically have to be the steward of your data over time, which in some ways can be good because you have control over it. In other ways, it's a little bit tricky because you don't have those extra incentives to look at the data and think about it long term.
If someone were to go ahead and develop an app based on these same principles or keep track of that data, I guess that would raise a new set of questions about security, what you used your data for, what someone else uses your data for.
Yeah, who's holding on to the data? How long are they holding it on to for? How is it kept? Is it anonymized? Is it attached to your name? And this company doesn't appear to be doing that yet. They're sending you an email at the end of each workout, but beyond that, they're not holding on to it. One thing that's interesting and worth thinking about is basically, as near as we can tell so far, fitness tracking hasn't totally exploded. A lot of people who wear wearables and wear wearables in order to track fitness, they'll do it for like 6 months and then they'll stop. And I mean, that sort of mirrors in some ways a lot of people's efforts to work out in the new year, right? So I think the question about a place like this is, does the kind of group activity serve as an added incentive to continue to track the data and use it to gain a better health? And I think that's still a question mark, but places like this are super popular.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Maybe you should work out a little more. I'm really tempted to call this segment Requiem for a Screen, because Yahoo has been having a pretty tough time lately. There was news this week that it's planning to cut 1,000 jobs,
and that it shut down Yahoo Screen, source of my bad pun, that was the video platform Yahoo launched in 2013. For more, we've got Marketplace's Adrian Hill, who covers entertainment for us. Hi, Adrian.
Hey, Lizzie.
I called this Requiem for a Screen because, honestly, nice. I've never used it. What was it?
Yahoo Screen was basically Yahoo's video streaming service. And it got a lot of attention when it live streamed the NFL game last year. I don't know if you remember that. I think it was in October. It streamed concerts via partnership with Live Nation. It hired Katie Couric as its global news anchor to create daily news videos.
Right. That I remember.
Uh-huh. Yahoo Screen was also home to Community after it left NBC. So for people who loved Community, that was where they watched it. They also had a sci-fi comedy called Other Space, another comedy called Sin City Saints, and really what you saw was Yahoo sort of making this move into television-style shows.
And then...
Dun, dun, dun! Things go dark.
Yeah, what happened?
Creating television is really expensive. In its quarterly earnings last October, Yahoo said it lost $42 million on original long-form video content like Community. Yeah. And it sounds like the company just decided to go in big and the bet didn't pay off. The CFO, Ken Goldman, said in that October conference call that, quote, "What we concluded is a certain of our original video content, we couldn't see our way to make money over time." The AV Club actually ran a headline, "Yahoo Screen is dead, and it's probably Community's fault."
I mean, it kind of sounds like he was calling out their own stuff.
Yeah. I think they just weren't the money makers they thought it would be.
So what does this mean for the content? They put a lot of money behind this for the big name players. What happens now?
Well, at this point, it's all getting moved to other parts of the Yahoo site or the Yahoo family of sites. So you can find Community and the other TV series in the TV sections. The stream concerts are going to be in the music section. Katie Couric is still creating her daily news report. So it's going to be there, but you're going to have to hunt around the Yahoo sites to find it. And maybe if you're hunting, you could find Lizzie's video on Yahoo Finance.
That's true. I did do some things for Yahoo Finance. Thank you, Adrian.
Yes.
But when you think about the company overall, I mean, even in comparison to something like Netflix, which said this week that it's global, barring a few countries, you know, what's the signal here?
Probably not good. I mean, Yahoo is spinning this as a content reorganization more than anything. But Yahoo's a company that's in a lot of trouble right now. Like you mentioned at the top, there are reports Yahoo could lay off 10% of its workforce. Shareholders are grumbling more and more loudly about Yahoo's leadership. So watch your back, Marissa Meyer. And look, we live in a world where original content is king. Streaming services like Netflix are doing this really well. So far, Yahoo hasn't succeeded, and that bodes poorly. So, Lizzie, I'm going to give you the least satisfying and probably most honest way to end any news story. We'll see.
Time will tell.
Only time will tell.
Marketplace's Adrian Hill, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
All that tech that we've been talking about comes with one very nasty after effect. Waste, or more specifically, e-waste. Millions of tons of electronic waste from North America and Europe end up in developing countries every year. And workers in parts of Africa and Asia make their livings scavenging the valuable metals from it. The BBC's Ed Butler went to one of the biggest e-waste dumps in the world in Ghana and saw workers putting their own health at risk.
Well, I've come about 10 kilometers outside of the center of Accra. And I've arrived at what is the largest dump in the capital. This is a waste rubbish dump. All kinds of rubbish you can imagine. From old lorries, discarded buses, garden waste, and a huge amount as well of electronic waste. This is one of the biggest electronic waste dumps in the world. That's the side of the old casing of a computer here. And there's the front of it, and I mean, there's a big pile, it's taller than I am, in front of me, of old computer casings, 2 or 3 meters tall. Everything here has a value, and everything can be eviscerated, pulled out, burnt in many cases, just to get rid of the plastics in it that aren't of use, and to pull out the metals, which always, it seems, have some kind of resale value.
Wait.
I've just come down the road now, and I'm just on our right. There's a big pile of computer screens, monitors being picked apart. And I'm with Sam Sandu. He's one of the scrap dealers who works here on this site. Sam, you recycle a lot of the waste here. How are you dismantling, let's say, a computer screen? What's the value inside a computer screen?
The value inside is you take a motherboard from it, and you take small aluminium from it, and also small cables in it, and you dispose the glass and the shell. We don't have any use of it. So then you just dispose it here or burn it over.
So it's the aluminium, it's the copper.
Yeah.
How much money is a computer screen worth to you?
You cannot predict one how much you get from it. That's what we do here, because where you get like 10 to 20 pieces, then you can be lucky.
So it's just a few pennies maybe per one screen, but you can, when you have enough screens, you can make a good living, right, Sam?
Yes, yes. It's instant job.
It's an instant job.
Yeah, because today you work on it faster, you get your money at the same day.
While the workers scraping a living from this dump rely on a steady stream of electronic goods from Europe, some legitimately exported to feed West Africa's appetite for cheaper second-hand goods, some just broken rubbish smuggled out against international environmental regulations. But the toxic nature of much of the waste is having a massive impact. The air here is unbearable. It took me hours after leaving just to feel that I could breathe normally again. Atiemo Samson is an environmental research scientist working at the Ghana Atomic Energy Commission. He says the dump is slowly poisoning its population.
When you take e-waste in general, you come across two types of toxic substances, what we call the heavy metals and then organic residues. The heavy metals, you can think of mercury, lead, cadmium, arsenic. These are the four most toxic substances that can happen anywhere. Precursors of cancer, they cause all sorts of neurological problems for children.
What do you think is the solution?
European countries have the money and probably the resources to manage these waste in a sound manner. In Africa, we don't. There is a growing acceptance that the producer of the equipment must bear responsibility for the end-of-life management.
So what do electronics firms have to say about this? Walter Alcorn is the Vice President of Environmental Affairs at the U.S. Consumer Technology Association.
Well, we're making sure, first of all, that in the country that we represent, the United States, that our manufacturers and our programs make sure that those products do not end up being dumped in developing countries. The other thing that we're doing is designing products and making new products that don't have those materials.
Nonetheless, are you not obliged to take some responsibility for the recycling itself, particularly in poor countries? I mean, you are producing something that is toxic.
I think our primary responsibility as an industry is to produce products that are environmentally safe and that do not cause these problems downstream. And that's what we're doing. We're really working through a legacy period of time where we're looking at legacy products that were produced 10 and 20 years ago. I think ultimately over the next 10, 20 years, we'll see this go away. And I think, you know, as manufacturers and retailers of these devices, that's our primary responsibility, is to put safe products on the market that meet consumer demand.
That's Ed Butler. The story came to us from our partners at the BBC. And that's our show for this week. We want to keep this conversation going. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? Come tell us about your economic life. Visit our website, marketplaceweekend.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call 1-800-648-5114. Your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan and Haley Hirschman. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Daniel Ramirez is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.